Good evening, everyone, and welcome to our seventh Pub Theology in Adelaide. Tonight we've got the special pleasure of having Mrs. Anna Crone over from Melbourne to speak on looking for love in all the right places. So it's a talk on love and that kind of stuff. So to introduce her, I've asked her husband to, because I thought he'd know her quite well, being her husband. And Anthony's going to introduce it with a prayer and a bit about her bio. Okay, thanks, Anthony.
Thank you. Do we begin with the prayer? Okay. Some of you may know this prayer and some may not. If you do, join in, and if not, don't worry, there's an amen at the end of it. Come, Holy Spirit, fill the hearts of thy faithful and kindle in them the fire of thy love. Send forth thy Spirit, O Lord, and they shall be created, and thou shalt renew the face of the earth. Let us pray. O God, who has sent thy Holy Spirit to lighten the hearts of thy faithful, grant that in that same Holy Spirit we may be truly wise and ever rejoice in his consolation through Christ our Lord. Amen. For Anna and for me, thank you for your welcome. For Anna and for me, it's a return to Adelaide. We lived here for a few years when Anna was working at the Southern Cross Bioethics Centre down at Marion. We lived in Mile End. We, a number of times, used to come and have meals at this pub, though I don't think we ever stood up to address the entire pub on any of those occasions. You've come here to hear Anna, so I'm not going to rabbit on for ages, but some of you may know Anna and even remember her from when we were here before. Others may not. Anna, for a number of years, has been involved, and I think probably for all of your adult life, involved in the study of theology. At the moment, Anna's continuing to study theology. She's working for a doctorate at the John Paul II Institute in Melbourne, working on the theology and philosophy of Dietrich von Hildebrand, notable German philosopher, theologian, and somebody who had an adventurous life contesting and running away from the Nazis. She's also been involved in adult education for a lot of recent years. At one stage in charge of Catholic adult education for the Diocese of Melbourne. More recently, having convened Anima Education and Anima, a network for women, which is spreading from Victoria around the country. She's the coordinator of the Carolyn Chisholm Library, which is a Catholic library, a continuation of the Central Catholic Library in Melbourne, and it's a place where lots of events, including things like this, go on. There are a number of other things that Anna does. She's been involved in bioethics, and she's a bioethics consultant to the Catholic Women's League. But I think probably she describes herself most basically as a teacher and an educator. For many years, she's been involved with and even a lay member of the Dominican Order. I think some of you know Brother or Father Manes. And I suppose a Dominican thing is to try to help others to understand the gospel. As we're in a pub, I thought that I would just leave the introduction with a thought. There is a book by a Dominican on Dominican theology, and it speaks about wine and even about drunkenness. And there is a reference to St. Catherine of Siena, who says that God is drunk with love for our good. And she says also, St. Catherine, I sense my soul once again becoming drunk. Thanks be to God. Well, on that happy note in the pub, I hand you over to Anna. Thank you.
Not sure about drunk in Lent. It's probably a bit of a problem. Thank you, everybody, for welcoming me. My topic tonight is finding love in all the right places, even in a pub, I suppose. And I find that I do a lot of teaching of nurses at Australian Catholic University, and I've had lots of conversations with mostly women, but there's a lot of young men doing nursing as well. And it seems to me that love is one of the big imponderables, the biggest mysteries, I think, that we all face. Am I right? I don't think there'd be so many people here if it wasn't a topic on everybody's mind. And I usually start this type of talk by asking a really, really deep philosophical question. And don't worry, because I've actually asked this in one of the toughest boys' schools in Melbourne. I walked into a very, very hormonally challenging group of teenage boys once, and I thought, help. When I walked in, and I thought, how am I going to get these guys to think? So I said, look, I'm not going to talk about... The topic I was given, by the way, was intimacy. You can imagine what that was like. You've got a topic of intimacy with a whole bunch of guys really just sort of slathering in the audience. And I thought, not at me, I might add, but just whatever was going on in their heads. And I thought, what am I going to do? And I said, well, look, I tell you what, guys, I want you to think, I want to introduce you to a couple of classical philosophers, Plato and Aristotle. And I hear this kind of what going through the audience. And I said to them, I want to ask you a philosophical question. Okay, I'm going to give you time to think about this, and I'll ask you the same question. So if 15-year-old boys can do it, you can do it too. I want you to think very deeply, and I want you to be honest, and tell me, who here does not want to find true love? And I'll give you 5 minutes. Do you need 5 minutes to think about this? Could somebody... Who doesn't want to find true love? And I, you know, can we just have a show of hands? No one here. What about beautiful love? Does anyone want to find, not want to find beautiful love? Good love? People are a bit iffy about good, you know. But the beautiful and the true, they do know they want. Am I right? Yep. No one? And I did this with these boys, you see. I said, I'll give you a lot of time to think about it. I'll be lenient. And there was this kind of really puzzled look. But you know what? They became very, very quiet and very contemplative. And one boy said, yelled out, but miss, everybody does. And I thought, isn't that interesting? Even despite all the challenges and the confusion that goes on in the world, that even in a school where people would probably want to shock you if they could, almost everybody in the room agreed they wanted to find true love. And so the topic of today's talk is about finding it and how you recognise it when you find it. And I thought I'd start with a quote from a man who I think is a philosopher, who is a modern-day philosopher, who is very, very insightful about our modern condition. And so I want you to think of his insight into this finding of love. We all know that we want it, but how the heck do we find it? And the man's name is Roger Scruton. He's written a couple of really good books. One's called An Intelligent Person's Guide to Culture. They're very readable introductions to the philosophy of culture. But he's also very insightful about what we might call the dot-com generation. And this is what he says. He says, human beings are wanderers. They roam the world in search of adventure. And this love of adventure creates a need for home. Homecoming makes wandering worthwhile. The adventures which tempt us today are far easier to embark on than the journeys of our ancestors across the seas. And they seem to be entirely without danger. We travel around the world with a click of a mouse. We visit friends and strangers on the screen, chat on our mobile phones, post on our Facebooks, our Facebook walls, all the things that we want the world to know. We can sit at our desk and enjoy every kind of thrill at no cost in danger, or so we think. But all the while, the World Wide Web is reaching out to us, and we are caught like flies, wriggling and suffocating in the bonds of screen addiction. And it's only when we realise that we don't know the way back, that we are sitting at our desk, but far, far away from home, It's then that we realise that the power of gadgets to enter and possess the human soul is brought out by the new technology. Now, I think that's a really wonderful insight into where we are at the moment. And I want to start our discussion about finding love with three scenarios and three current kind of discussions that are going on. Three areas that are critical to our finding true love. Two are very public issues, and one is a very personal one. The first is that, and many of you may have seen this film, has everyone seen the James Cameron film Avatar? Now, you're going to have fans and people who hate it and so on. But the story is a journey, isn't it? It's a journey of a man who finds that he despairs of humanity in a way. Humanity is a pretty hopeless mess. And instead of travelling across the seas, he does something that's even weirder than any of the journeys that the great adventurers like Odysseus and Dante and all the great adventurers of classical literature do. And what's that? What's his journey consist in? He so despairs of his humanity that the only way he can find true love, true people, true cause, anything to believe in, is by actually becoming a non-human, by becoming a type of being that's got kind of purple-blue blotches on it and a tail and very greeny qualifications. But what's interesting about the story is he actually goes out of his body. He gives up his body, his whole body. The whole idea of the body being virtual is celebrated in the movie Avatar. In other words, the real heaven is when you can get rid of that body that ties you to the dismal history of humanity. And the humanity, he leaves humanity behind in a kind of hopeless mess. There's only one hopeful figure in the human race, and that's a kind of Joan of Arc figure who doesn't find true love but kind of whacks her helicopter into some super spaceship. Do you remember the film? Do you remember this kind of non-story? But it's not really a story, but it is interesting because it does represent a kind of hopeless dead end about one thing, and that is being embodied. An avatar is a made-up virtual body that's just this man somehow inserts himself into, if such a thing were possible. So the body is the first thing. Having a body, being a body, embodiment, being human, involves being embodied. And it's one of those parts of the journey that we don't quite understand. The second thing I want to talk about is a debate that's been taking place amongst some philosophers, particularly amongst feminist philosophers recently, even in the pages of The Australian. And that is about why it is that women have given up on romantic love. And that has all kinds of debating topics. Martha Nussbaum wrote a critique of somebody else writing about romantic love. These big names, the biggest names in philosophy, especially feminist philosophers, are saying, what's gone wrong? Wasn't this whole adventure of feminism supposed to be a liberation for us sexually, in a family sense, career-wise, intellectually? Somewhere along the line, we broke our hearts. Somewhere along the lines, our hearts were broken and they're not unbroken. Nussbaum writes very fluently about this, that we've lost virtue and we've lost the ability to know where our hearts are. And I think she's very right. Many of the young women I have spoken to believe that it's their fate to be abused sexually. Just happens. Kind of necessary evil. Terminating a pregnancy is a necessary evil if you want to keep your freedom. And what happens about love? Oh, well, it kind of gets lost along the way. There's a tragic fatalism about that. And if women can talk about it, and let's face it, women are much better at talking about their hearts, I figure the same is going on with men. Am I right, men? Is there a kind of brokenness also? They won't tell us, of course, will they? Because they don't talk about their hearts. But men have hearts, and they're broken just as easily. They just don't have a language for it very often. So the second thing I want to talk about is a theology of the heart, which is where I'm doing my study at the moment, that the heart is a central part of who it is to be a human being. And the third area that I want to talk about, and I want to share with you some wisdom of a six-year-old. I've got a little nephew called Max, and he kind of reminds me of the kid out of Where the Wild Things Are, so we call him Max as well. He was doing something funny, pretending he was fencing or doing something, and I said, "Gosh, you're a funny little thing." And he got very indignant, and he said, "I am not a thing. I'm a person." And I thought, gee, if only everybody had the wisdom of that six-year-old. I'm not a thing, I'm a person. And he knew what that meant. He really knew what that meant. He knew the whole implication of being called a thing, which we sometimes say, you're a funny thing. But he thought about it very philosophically and said, I'm not a thing, I'm a person. So what I want to suggest today is that we cannot really make a great heroic journey to the true, the good, beautiful love that we all want, unless we have a compass that tells us how to negotiate the mysteries of having and being a body, tricky, having and living with a heart and not becoming heartless or hardened in heart. And thirdly, what does it mean to be a person and not a thing? Now, not surprisingly, these three areas of the body, the heart, and being a person are central to the interests and the philosophy of the two most recent popes in the Catholic Church. John Paul II concentrated on the whole dimension of the body, and many of you will probably have heard a little bit about his theology of the body. He spent so long trying to understand how to communicate with people, what it means to have a language of the body. The body is you. Your body is you. Yes, it has limitations. Yes, you have big hips. Yes, you have acne. But also it's the way you love. You can't get an avatar to love for you because you love in who you are using the language of your body. You can't just wipe it out. You can try and do what Madonna does or Sure, remove a few hips to have a smaller waist. But we see what happens to those poor women who try to change themselves by kind of assaulting their body with all the technology of the beauty industry. We know in the end it leaves people hollow. And we also know that Pope Benedict has spent a lot of his life studying the heart. The heart is his great area of theology, the whole question of love and how we feel. And it's he that began his pontificate by saying, Christianity is not a theory, it's an event. And he then has this whole exegesis on the heart. And it kind of, my impression was when he wrote that encyclical that it even struck those crusty old hearts of the journalists around the world, that they got that there was something resonating there for them. Both the popes were interested in the idea of the person, and both of them were sure that we are all on a pilgrimage, that we need to travel to really realise these three areas of our life. So, let's have a look at them each in turn. First of all, the body. What does it mean to be embodied? What does it mean to be a body and have a body? What does it have to do with love and beautiful things? Because so very often we think we're not beautiful in a physical sense. And how can we find true love beyond Botox and vitamin pills? And you know better than I do how much emphasis is put on body beautiful. It's interesting, there was a survey recently to try and work out what people thought about body image, and there were pictures of women in their bathers, size 8, 10, 11, 12, you know, all the different sizes. And it was interesting, despite what people say about men, men's reaction was, I like that size there because she's got nice eyes. And they were allowed to say whatever they liked, but they said, she looks like she's got a good personality. I think she looks the happiest with who she is. And I thought, be good if women really heard men say things like that, because most of the time they're oppressing each other about their body image. And I thought, yeah, it's very interesting. They're not measuring people with a tape measure, and if they are, it's their problem. Let's talk about the heart. The heart is more than our interior. It's not just emotions. It's not just our feelings. It's what where we experience things. It's not just about pleasure. It's also about peace and our ability to respond to others, our ability to feel joy, gratitude, awe, reverence. And my doctorate is about saying that we've neglected that area of our life. We don't think that our heart is made for truth. We think, oh, as long as you entertain your heart and you play with it like a music box, it's all right. But my experience is, and I think I was quoted on this, much to my embarrassment, when a philosopher at Notre Dame rang me up and said, hey, I heard you said that you can't put condoms on a heart. I thought, great, I'm now being reported for saying that. And I said, the point was people talk a lot about safe sex or safe relationships and negotiating their way through relationships. But you can't simply block up the heart, because the heart is really the centre of the person. And certainly the Bible represents it as the centre of the person, the feeling centre, the moral centre, the place where you answer your vocation, the place that Jesus tells you to go and be with when you shut your room at night. It's where you meet the Father. So the heart is a central part of who people are, and most people know it. The heart is what reminds us that we're larger on the inside than we are on the outside. I often say that to my students, you're bigger on the inside than you are on the outside. All I see is the language of your heart or the language of your body telling me something about the mystery that you are. Our spiritual life wants to reach out from our heart to know and to find our heart's desires. We often use that. What is your heart's desire? And it was John Paul II and Pope Benedict who said, what is your heart's desire? And I think when I asked you the question about true love, I was touching that place, wasn't I? What is your heart's desire? What do you want to find? Again, the Old Testament does speak about these three areas of the person. The Old Testament looks at the idea of the flesh, the body, the breath, that is the life of you, the life in you, and thirdly, a more mysterious place, the spirit, the breath of God in you. Many people can relate to the fact that they've got flesh, they can relate to life, but they don't believe that they have any spirit, they don't believe they're spiritual. So the Avatar film was all about life, and there was a kind of new pagan spirituality about it, a hunting for a spirituality, if you remember. A spirituality that was kind of related to the earth in some way. But it was aware, it was tapping into a hunger, a spiritual hunger that I think many people find while they're trying to look for love. So I want to argue today that the mind and the heart and the body are all integrated, that they all rely on our intellect being trained and strengthened and acknowledged to find the truth. And that if we try to talk about the body or the mind without the heart, we're deforming ourselves, not as human beings, but as robots or golems. You know those figures that you probably saw in the X-Files, those kind of bodies without souls. Actually part of Jewish mythology. A golem is a living flesh with no soul, no personality. Or as angels, we're not angels. You know those Bugs Bunny cartoons when people die, or Sylvester dies, and you see an angel float out. His soul is just an angel. We're not going to get into the issue of the theology of cat souls or Sylvester souls, but we actually have souls. We actually are spiritual beings as well as physical and living ones. So each of these areas of ourselves, the person, the heart, and the body, has a language. And the thing that's so significant about Christianity is that Christianity believes that who you are as a person and what you have as a heart and who you are in your body is a gift. You didn't make it. You were given it. And there's much about all of those realities that may even seem to be a burden to you. I'm only 5'1". I have this health condition. I have this temperament, and I'm struggling with it. I have a heart that blows up or gets hurt. But the really significant thing, I think, about the Christian message is that God is working in precisely the language that he made you in. He didn't make you deliberately ill, but that is part of the challenge. That is part, I suppose, of what St. Irenaeus would say is the stuff we make the glory out of if we respond in grace. So we are not accidents, as that famous, almost cliched saying goes, but our bodies, our hearts, our persons are irrepeatable. There's never going to be another combination of those three things for the rest of history. I can't simply zlit you away as an avatar. Who you are is essentially those three things. If I take one away or if I damage one of those things, I've really hurt you, haven't I? If we say to someone, I've broken your heart, something really deeply saddening has happened. The broken heart may be an opportunity for a new start. A broken body may be an opportunity for a new start. But this is the one body, mind and heart that you've got. So treasure it, it's a gift. I want you to think about how we treat gifts. What's the difference between a gift and a thing that's not a gift? And this is, again, getting quite close to John Paul II's theology, which is to say people are made for love and not use. Just as little Max could say so clearly and vehemently to me, I had to look a bit shamefaced and say, I only talk about this stuff all the time and you're telling me off for calling you a thing. If you are a gift, if you really believe that, and that's the challenge, how do we treat gifts? First of all, the gift that we are ourselves, heart, mind, body, person. And if other people are also gifts, it really changes the way we see people, doesn't it? It's a revolutionary view. It's quite a revolution. It was St. Francis of Assisi who, for instance, suddenly saw a leper, dazzling as a gift. And he said, until I could see a leper and love him, I was living in my sins. Until I was converted to see the glory of God, how God sees this person, I was blinded. The eye of my heart was blinded. Mother Teresa and many other people who have worked for the most broken people are people who see the gift, the uniqueness behind all the difficulties. So that's the starting point, realizing this giftedness. Now, it's not easy to see, and I'm the first one to acknowledge that you get up in the morning and you find most people annoying and yourself annoying and you get annoyed with yourself. So I want to bring one other theme into place here, and this is very important, because without one additional factor, it's very hard for us to do this. What did St. Francis have that made him see this in people and love people this way so freely? And that was an image that comes into the New Testament quite often, and St. Paul uses the image of salt. In the old liturgy of the church, the Catholic Church, when you were baptized, a baby had salt put on his or her tongue to be salt of the earth. The salt. What's salt do? Have a think about salt, and let's not go into the modern health traumas about salt. Let's talk about salt as it's been in the history of the world. Salt is a good Lenten image, isn't it? Salted fish. Salt is purifying. It preserves. It gives taste. Gives flavour. Anyone had porridge without salt? Or bread without salt? It's a little bit tasteless. So on top of our need to see these three areas of gifts, we know we can't do it. We simply don't have the capacity or the salt. We need to be salted, baptised or given the grace of Christ. We need to see with his heart. Now that's a tall order, but that's what the gospel is trying to tell us. So being salted means to have a heart that's purified. That is in attitude, thought, habit, and that's a long journey. Back to the journey again. But this time the journey is going somewhere. So they're some of the starting points for finding true love. That the heart, the mind, the body are all gifts and important, and that we're on a journey to a new heart. You know, the whole biblical image of taking out our hardened heart. You know, when you fail to love, you know that you're shutting something out, aren't you? The image in the Gospels and in the Old Testament is of a hardened heart. Remember that curious saying in the book of Exodus of Pharaoh's heart being hardened, kind of a blindness to love, a blindness to the truth. So it's not just a blindness of the mind or blindness of the eyes, but a blindness of the heart, a heart that's like a fist rather than a heart that receives. The work of Dietrich von Hildebrand is so important because he identifies the emotional, the affective life as a key player with the mind and the will. That the heart needs to be open. The heart has an ear and an eye. And often when I talk to young people, they go, yeah, I understand that. I really do. I can see that myself. So we've talked about the unique gift that everybody is, but also the fact that we need to be healed. It's not simply going around a Monopoly board with the dice just rolling evenly out. In fact, there's no dice. There's only providence. We don't know what that providence is doing in our lives. And we know we fall away from it all the time. But I know one conversation I had last week was interesting. Someone said, what happens if you've turned down, you've hardened your heart with somebody and you know you've made such a damaging impact on that person you can never go back and talk to them? What happens then? Is that like the end of the road? Does God just go, well, that's it now. I've tried to put a new heart into you and that's the end. As long as your heart's beating, as long as you're alive, even the last breath, if we think of the great scene and the end of Brideshead Revisited with Lord Marshmaine, unconscious, mumbling something, trying to, at the last moment, turning back, great sign of hope. That a person can, as long as your heart is beating, it has the chance to be kick-started again. And really, I think one of the images in the scriptures is that the heart is what's so damaged by sin. I think today people go, oh yeah, well, so what, I'll get a new body. I'll make myself a new person. I'll go and start myself again. I'll go on Facebook. I have a very favourite cartoon, which I did a lot of writing on the internet at one stage. And there's a great Far Side cartoon of two little dogs sitting on a computer. And one little dog is typing away on the computer and the other one looks up and says, what's so great about the internet is nobody needs to know you're a dog. So there's this real sense that we can be something else. It's almost like a great fantasy, isn't it? And why I think people get so addicted to it is you can pretend to be what your heart desires. But we know it's not enough. It's the same myth that I think challenges the debate at the moment, the feminist debate about whether the porn culture really helps women or not. I think it's a pretty obvious answer. But part of it is based on this kind of fantasy that unbridled desire, lust, is going to make everybody liberated, free and happy. Because it relies so heavily on fantasy. The fantasy that the person looking at you in the whatever kind of porn it is really is interested in you. And you can treat it like a thing. And you can somehow get a moment's pleasure out of it. But you know in your heart it's a sickening kind of pleasure. It's one that just gets you into a spiral of kind of a nasty aftertaste and a spiral of abuse and feeding off it. And if you don't think it's a big issue, I was talking recently to a person who's been a great campaigner against the sexualisation of children, and she happened to state how powerful the pornography industry was, and the next day she received on her blog pages threats of rape and death. Roger Scruton isn't joking. This is a different kind of journey and it's a downward spiralling journey. It's not a journey anywhere. except into nothingness. And many young women and young men are play acting what they are told from this raunch culture that says what you need to be is desired. Okay, you need to make yourself a piece of meat. And once you do that, people will desire you, and that's what you want. That's going to liberate you. You are now powerful. And if you ever see those young women go out to the races, you know, all dressed up in their ladies' clothes, high heels, playing at being feminine, because it's their heart's desire to do that, it's natural enough to want to do that, and coming home at the end of the day, wasted. Literally wasted. The word wasted is a really good one, isn't it? Because that's exactly what they are. They're wasted. So they go out in the day thinking, I'm going to play at being a lady. That's my heart's desire. At the end of the day, they're thrown on the trash heap. And that just doesn't happen at those events. It happens regularly in every nightclub, in every cafe in town. And it's not just young people. People who think, oh, the young people are the ones having this problem. Forget it. You only have to open the newspaper to work out how many trophy boyfriends, girlfriends, spouses, wives, mistresses are thrown out and over for a new model. So people start with a desire for true love and end up being a thing. And that's not the way you find true love. But that's the message. The message is it's really easy, it's fast, it's quick, it's a quick shot. You can feed it Viagra to make it keep lasting longer. How pathetic. It's interesting to notice that one of the things that's left out of this equation of finding love in all the right places and looking at those ads that you see on the end of the night, they're getting worse, aren't they? They're just more and more sad and tragic. You keep turning on, you go, oh, it must be 12 o'clock because, oh, there's all these poor Russian women who are being trafficked to do something about how much they love the men they're looking at through the screen. It's really, really sad. It's a new form of slavery. And the girls themselves may say, oh, but I'm very powerful. I get, you know, $2,000 a photo. But they never get out of it in one sense or another. The myth is that this makes women powerful. If you ask them what they really wanted, they'd say, like you, I want to find true love. And maybe I can make a bit of money on the side and then get and find a true partner, a true person to love me. The word that's left out, and one that I'd like to sort of think about, how am I going, Michael? Nearly time to finish? Because I want to leave time for some questions. The thing that they'd like to say is, I want to find a noble lover. The word noble. It's one that is never used on after 12 o'clock. You don't see someone coming on saying, look at Selena, look at her. She's just come from Russia and she's going to have a noble experience with you. That word does not happen, does it? You might say exciting, exotic. It's all about bits of her. She never says, I want to have a lasting, noble relationship with you, does she? No. Because people are scared of that. And I think that's part of what this new debate is, that we're, in a way, we're less adventurous than the people of the past. We're more scared than we have ever been of commitment, of really giving ourselves to someone else, really heart, soul and mind. It's scary because the compasses are all kind of like demagnetized, aren't they? We're out there without a compass, floating around going, what are the rules? I don't know which way to go. And again, I say to you, it's not, I talk to people who are much older than all of you guys here, and they're struggling as well. They've been in marriages for a long period of time or in relationships of some kind that they thought were faithful, and the rules have all changed. And the rules are touching a whole wide range of areas. John Paul II says it's not just love relationships and sexuality that's confused, it's also even the role identity of being a parent. I remember hearing a conversation in a cubicle, in a Myers cubicle, and it really touched me as being part of this whole conditional love thing. I'll love you this much, but I'm not really signing up for the deal because I'm too scared. I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. No, you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. That's part of the adventure, is putting yourself in the boat and travelling with that person to wherever the journey goes. That's what makes it a great adventure. That's what makes for all great adventures, as long as you've got good compasses. Now people go, I haven't got any compasses, but I'm the pilot of the ship, and I don't accept anyone else will tell me how I'm going to play this game or how I'm going to travel this journey. Imagine trying to go out on a ship without any instruments at all to measure where you're going and saying, it's okay, I'm not going to listen to anyone, I'm not going to listen to tradition, I'm not going to listen to the church, forget that. I'm out doing it on my own devices. And what people end up with is not freedom, but fate. The fates carry them. And then they get really scared that the fates are going to destroy them, so they just lock themselves in. I remember this woman saying, she was trying on some clothing, and she said to the shop assistant, I'm 2 months pregnant. And the woman said, oh, congratulations, that's great. She goes, no, I'm not allowed to say that I'm pregnant yet, because I've married a man who's had a previous family and he wants me to have all the genetic tests, and I'm not allowed to talk about this pregnancy until all the tests are clear. He does not want a baby, has anything wrong with it. So I'm not allowed to say anything. And she said, the shop assistant felt a bit, you could tell from her voice, I'm sorry, it was a terrible eavesdropping thing to do, but it was just a great description of what we call this, what John Paul would call this culture of death, this tentative pregnancy, this tentative love, this tentative marriages, these tentative engagements. Tentative because people are too frightened, and quite naturally they're frightened because there's no compasses, there's no bearings. So she says, I'm not allowed to say I'm pregnant until all the tests are clear. She said, aren't you, is this your first baby? She said, yes, it is, but I'm not allowed to be happy. So now, that's right. And so now people are actually afraid to have a heart or have a body or be a person. They think it's asking too much in a relationship. A young woman said to me once when I said, you're a person, you're entitled to these, but I'll never find anybody else if I play by those rules. If I lower my standards, at least I'll have someone. And I go, but you won't have them. Don't you understand that if you just will be used in that circumstance rather than having a real relationship? She goes, but that's the only way I'll get someone. I've got to go down to this level, because if I pretend I've got a heart or a body, or that I'm a person, that I'm a spiritual person, or I'm a spiritual being, I have a destiny, that's playing for too high a stakes. I'll be left on the shelf. And my question is, our vocation is to find betrothed love. That means a love that is built on what John Paul calls the ethos of the gift. What is that about? Well, that means, first of all, that somebody to whom you love, in whom you love, whether that's whatever your walk of life, and you've got to listen to what your vocation is. You may be single, you may be married, you may be widowed, you may be a religious, you may be a priest. That may be what you're called to be. But it will depend on a covenant. That's a risk. It's taking a guaranteed risk, because a covenant is made on God and God's grace. The second thing is that most covenanted love requires a sign. What do we do when people get married? They invite everybody they know, don't they? They're taking a big risk. I'm inviting everyone I know, and I'm promising that I'm going to love this person forever. That's really brave. That's true courage, not the courage of getting in a ship and throwing away all the instruments. It's a public, most people do kind of private relationships. You notice a lot of people are cohabiting because they kind of don't want it to be too public. They kind of slip into a relationship, and one of the relationships is usually going, this will end in marriage, and the other person's going, we'll wait and see. So there's no mutuality. There's often one person's at this level of the relationship and the other person's going, if I just hang in here, I'll wear this guy down. He'll eventually marry me. And the tragic thing is quite often the guy will up and find somebody else and say, oh, I'm sorry, I'm off. Or maybe the other way around, it may be the woman in the circumstance. But so often there's not this shared giving of a sign. Now, it's not just married people that do that. Some people say, I'm going to go and help the poor in Africa. And to do that, I'll stay single and I'm going to put myself on the line. That's what I'm going to dedicate my life. A great person example of that is Moira Kelly, the woman who brings in the sick. Her life is dedicated to that. She's consecrated to it. But a consecrated religious does that in a more formal way. A priest does that too. It's betrothed love. That's true love. It's betrothed. I said, can't do it to Father Manes, but I said to Father Dom when I saw him in the audience, I said, Father Dom has got his white wedding dress on. Father Manes typically has a black wedding dress on, which is in character with Father Manes, but he's wearing it publicly. He's wearing a sign. You're a black friar. He's wearing a sign. He's dedicated his body to the love of his life. It's a sign. Another thing that true love requires is a kind of total self-giving, and that usually is done by some kind of promise or commitment. And again, people can do that whether they're single. It involves their sexuality as a noun and not a verb. Get the difference? Noun and not a verb. It's who they are. It's not just about having lots of sexual activity. It's about dedicating your whole sexuality to the true love of your life. Religious do this typically in celibacy. Married couples faithfully give themselves to each other and not everybody in the street. You notice there's a new program on TV called Big Love. It's about trying to get women, I reckon, and I'm a bit cynical about this because I'm a bit feminist about this, I think it's trying to soften women up to say, you know, polygamy's pretty cool. Polygamy's okay. Everyone can have quite a lot of fun with polygamy. One of the great contributions to women's liberation was Christianity's insistence on monogamy. That women did not have to share themselves, didn't have to share their husband with a whole lot of women. But that's already been weakened by the history of our culture, hasn't it? Women say, oh, of course I'm not meant to really mind because he's brought another girl home and he wants it to be a threesome because he really wants it, so I better do it. It's already been weakened, but just watch Big Love. The director actually said that was his intention, to open people's minds to the possibility of polygamy. It's cool. Most Mormons are not really doing it, but this whole program is dedicated to how cool it is and how interesting it is to have polygamy back again. There's only one man, there's a whole lot of girls. I haven't watched it, but this is an interview with the director. So it's a unique kind of vow, a giving of self, a giving of a word. And lastly, the thing that I think is very significant about true love, and if you're trying to work out whether it is true love, is that there's a life-giving quality to it. First of all, it gives you creative life. It recognises your gifts. It makes you fruitful as a man or a woman. Same is true for a priest or a religious or a single person who does this. It's one of the bravest things to do to open yourself to life. For married couples, obviously, it has a very real dimension of the openness to life. This risk, an even bigger risk than loving another person, is allowing other people else into your family. And I don't mean just your own children. I think families are also places that invite in other people, give life to other people. So true love gives life. It's open to life, it gives life. It affirms the masculinity or the femininity of the other. It's a daring adventure, much more daring than clicking your mouse and whizzing around the net, which is much more dangerous in one way, but much less dangerous in another. So I just want to end, we have asked some questions, just to give you some thoughts about that, by giving a quote from an interesting English Catholic writer called G.K. Chesterton, who said there are only two really brave things left to do in the world. One is to post a letter. Today you probably would have said send an email, because you can't get it back. Once you pop the letter in the letterbox, it's gone. Now we know how scary that is on the internet and how half-baked some of our emails are. Have you ever noticed that? And you go, oh, what did I send that for? And you never negotiate anything over the internet because you never quite get the meaning, do you, of what you want to say. So you always say, go walk around the block. I used to say to my staff when I had staff, before you send that email, go walk around the block. Think about what you've put in it and then send it when you've really thought it through. And I think that's what's happening. People are doing the email version of love. They click the mouse before they've thought about what they're doing. So letter is a brave thing. He said the other brave thing is marriage. And I'm not just saying that everyone, but I would broaden that and say betrothed love. Because I don't know what's going to happen to everybody. We live where the compasses have all been thrown out. And so it's a rocky road finding true love. But the true love might start with true friendship, which is a great way to start. That's the great foundation of all true love, is friendship. C.S. Lewis said, everyone thinks friendship is a kind of vegetarian kind of love, pale. But in fact, it's the most important kind of love. And all true relationships are based on, at the end, the love, the brotherly, sisterly love of friendship. And let's just end with one quote. If you think about the Bible, that great unusual figure, Tobias. Tobias was very aware that the woman he married was his sister, not in an incestuous sense, but that she was his equal, that she was, like Adam and Eve, kin, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. She's my equal. She's made in the image and likeness of God, just like me. And very often when I'm talking to young men, if I'm asking them what they think women should be treated like, I don't say, what do you think about that woman walking down the street? I say, what do you think about that woman if she was your sister? Ah, if she really is my sister, then I treat her with nobility. There's that word. So the first relationship is the sharing of mutual respect and the friendship that comes with being part of the same family. And then anything else flows from that. Hopefully attraction, which is a really wonderful part of true betrothed love. So it's not just vegetarian. It's not the tofu version of love. Tofu's okay. Okay, so I might end just there and see if anyone's got questions. And then we might have a little go at seeing if we can tell the difference between infatuation and love, which is kind of fun. Michael, do you want to chair it or shall I chair it? Have I said enough? Yeah. Leave it there.
Well, we'll take questions now, I guess. We'll give it a few minutes if anyone wants to think about questions, or are people ready to ask questions straight away? Okay, we've got questions straight away. Yep. I feel
like there were... Can you repeat? Sure. Yep, of course. There's a sort of self-giving aspect of it, the sign value, the covenant, the giving, the sort of commitment, if you like, self-givingness, the life-givingness of it. The life-givingness of it, that the fact that it affirms who you are. And people who find true love glow, don't they? You suddenly go, something's happened there. Even Martha Nussbaum, who's not a Christian, said true love gives life. True love gives life. You see people radiating with it. It's not just falling in love in that sappy sort of way. But what I think is really funny, horrible, is that true romance is really an adventure. We get a lot of what are called chick flicks. I don't consider Jane Austen a chick flick, by the way. She's a great philosopher. But chick flicks are kind of soft, fluffy, and frankly quite non-oomphy enough for me. I think women really want something with a bit of backbone. Am I right? You don't really want fluffy love, do you? Am I a tomboy or... No, thanks. Right. What they want is something with backbone. So they sort of watch chick flicks because the rest of their life is pretty grim. The rest of their love life is pretty much, but you know, difficult times. And the same for guys. I think guys sort of try and find some way of fantasizing because it's a pretty scary world out there. The love world is pretty scary these days. So I think true romance and the way that Nussbaum was recently talking about, surprisingly enough, she criticizes this kind of fluffy romance, which you don't find in Shakespeare and you don't find in Jane Austen and you don't find in the truly great love stories of the world. That they are about a great adventure of a quest, of a noble quest. And there are some in the Bible as well, interestingly enough. I think I've stunned it.
Chelsea.
Yeah. When I have a car and when I become this, yeah. I agree with you. I agree. There is a bit of fluffy romanticism going on there in a way. Understandable. And you don't. It's an idealism that you don't want to knock out. But... it's a great insight that Pope John Paul II had about true love and about the theology of the body, which I think is relevant here. When he does his exegesis of the creation of Adam and Eve, he goes through what he calls some very fundamental, basic experiences. When I asked you the question about true love, you were touching what he would call a fundamental experience, an original experience, something that's in, St. Paul writes, is written in the heart. Everybody knows they want true love. That's one bit of the compass that's still working in everybody. Everybody gets that. But how you get there is often where the problems start. He says the very first thing that Adam realizes after he's created is he experiences his original solitude. Now, many people doing theology of the body just make that a negative experience. John Paul says, actually, that's where you have your face-to-face relation. Remember, Adam's created quite a bit, in the Genesis story, he's created quite a bit of time before Eve, isn't he? He's basically got to grow up. Do you notice that? Adam's kind of there by himself, and he's given a task. He's got to do a quest. He's actually got to hoe the garden and name the animals. He's got quite a lot to do. And his first relationship is a commandment he's given by God. Remember that? He's got to not eat of the tree of good and evil. He's given a moral commandment. And John Paul just gives a little side hint of that. We have to be able to live with ourselves before God first. I used to say sex is for adults. It's for people who are grown up and can give themselves, who have what John Paul calls self-possession. You don't have, a lot of young women go running around to relationships to make themselves, a little bit like you say, Chelsea, I will be this when I have a guy. I'll be a better woman when I have a guy. Well, you might be, but you've got a lot of work to do with God and yourself. Basically, you've got to be mature enough to sustain that kind of covenant love. Now, you'll get a lot of grace to do that, but it's not for babies. And I think sometimes women go, when I get a guy, then I'll be really virtuous. Time to start now. And it's a bit, as much as I think the organisation True Love Waits has got a great idea, I often say, well, what are you doing while you're waiting for true love? You've got a whole lot of things to be and respond to now. You've got your life to live, and you've got your own maturity and your own virtue and your own character and your own self-giving right now. So I think what you're referring to is very true. People say, everything will be like this over there. The thing is, to get to over there, you've got to do it now. You've got to be in the present. You've got to live in what the great mystic calls the sacrament of the present moment. There's grace working right now on you, calling you right now. If you keep saying, I'll wait for a guy to help me get it, well, I don't know. I think that's putting it, it's idealising. And also, you can also have images from TV soap operas about marriage. One of the things I find is that people idealise marriage in a more fluffy way the more the raunch culture takes off. You notice that Cosmo's on the shelf next to Bride magazine. So the more women are sort of go and be a raunchy, raunchy girl, this is what you wear, the more they're fantasising about a fluffy, big production wedding. You don't find that in basic, say, Italian villages 200 years ago. People go, well, marriages have got to do this. We have a marriage, we have the wedding, and then we get on with our lives. We don't have this big theatrical. I mean, you wanted a beautiful wedding, and I'm not trying to knock that or knock the beauty of a marriage and the wonder, you know, the fantasy of having a lovely wedding day. But when you hear that most Australians spend over $30,000 for their wedding, they're laying so much in to that very thing that you talk about, Chelsea. Somehow if I put more money into the production day, that'll be a better marriage. Instead of saying, well, who are we and what are we bringing to this marriage ourselves? I often say to young people, you're better off having a barbecue on the beach and really spending time being the best that you can be for each other. That would make a fantastic wedding. And everybody would just be over the moon at that wedding, because you'd see it. So save on the bucks and work on yourself, I think. Work on the grace in your own life. And I think that's my suggestion there.
I've got a question from Joe on the left here. Joe?
She's allowed to have a little bit of fantasy. No, I mean, a wedding is a beautiful day, and everyone wants to do it because you want it to be the most beautiful gift it can be. But honestly, I remember a young teacher telling me that she had chosen not to live with her fiancé before she got married. She thought, I wanted to save my new adventure of marriage from the day on. And she's found that was really interesting. The other teachers who'd been kind of living together, they had to... What was the marriage doing? The marriage day was kind of, well, what is it adding to our... we don't know. We better go and watch the video and find out what made that day so special. So instead of looking forward together to the adventure of a new life together, which they'd already had kind of confused a little bit. I'm not saying that marriage wouldn't work. But do you see how the emphasis was they actually lived together to save up money to get married? That's kind of confused. Can you see how it's sort of saying, I'll save up enough money, I'll live with you now, kind of start to be married to you now, and then I'll save up enough money so I have a great wedding day. And then I think, well, what difference did the wedding day make? We better watch videos about it and find out. And this girl, this is just this girl's insight. And I thought she had something really interesting to say there, that somehow or other, that not, I guess in a more, where you save all this celebration of the gift to the wedding day, you then move into the future. You don't actually get time to watch a video together because everything you're doing is a new adventure. And I thought she had a really interesting insight. And so do have some nice flowers, but save yourself some money. Don't angst so much about the money that you need for the wedding day. Because really what the wedding day is about is you two. You two. And that's what your friends come to celebrate. Honestly, a barbecue on the beach can be a lot of fun.
Joe, I think that's the response you wanted. No.
Get good sausages, though.
Get good sausages, okay. Questions? Yeah, Matthew.
Well, I think, in fact, it's not lowering your standards at all. I think what you're doing is actually really... I used to say this to young men. A beautiful heart is one of the most incredibly attractive qualities in a man. A beautiful heart. I mean, I don't mean that everyone's made for everybody else. I don't think that's true either. But I think it is true that sometimes young women think there's only one man in the world and he's already out there somewhere. He may be. But there may be at least three people who might. And this is, a big debate. People will say, what is it? God doesn't... I've got a friend who says this, and he's a bishop, so he probably should know. He says, God doesn't run in tram tracks. If the person you thought was the love of your life has moved on and got married to somebody else, there may be a really wonderful person. There is sometimes some other person out there who's decent and wonderful that you haven't looked at with the right eyes yet. And I don't mean let's bring back arranged marriages, because I don't think that's necessarily always a happy thing in this culture at all. I don't think it is. But it is surprising how people sometimes you don't think are going to end up together actually do and have the best marriages that you can find. Because it's this, I think it's the eye of the heart again, that's what really is important. I do think you should fall in love with the person, and you can't make that happen. And this is, again, Dietrich von Hildebrand's point. You can't will yourself to love someone you just don't love. So don't try and do that either. That's kind of forced, and nobody wants to say, I'm really trying to love you. I promise I'm trying to love you. That's really not quite what your beloved wants you to say. It should be a gift. And falling in love is that kind of gift. You have ups and downs after that time, of course you do. But you may be surprised that really the qualities that go for good love are not necessarily the things that appear in Cosmo or Dolly. And I think you're right about that, that women often have in their head a younger version of what they think is ideal. And sometimes with a bit of life experience, they suddenly think, no, the qualities that really make for a great man are this, this and this. And I suggest the heart is one very big factor there. The same for men for women. The heart is a huge part. Men seem to be happy enough to talk about the heart of women. It's interesting. Women are worried about their bodies, and men are actually often quite interested in hearts. But at the same time, they've got the whole raunch culture to try and get out of their system, because that's playing in their head at the same time. I don't know whether the guys would admit to that, but it's true, isn't it? That's running as a kind of video in your head while you're trying to find true love, and that makes it very complicated. Scary question from Anthony. Sure, I think that's right. Don't go out and buy a book, How to Fall in Love. You can't make that happen. But what you can do is, I think, really work on this, what I suppose is this grace-filled cultivation of virtue, of the Beatitudes. Even more so, that's a great ingraced virtue, which is being open to grace and being transformed by that. If you work on being in love with God, you will be a lovely person. That's what a saint is a person who's so beautiful because they allow God to work in their life. They allow God to do the work. It's not just a colouring in by numbers. And very often it's when you stop thinking about yourself that really starts to take place. And that, I think that's what happens when people fall in love too. They stop actually stop thinking about themselves. They're so caught up in the love of the other person, and that's what makes them so beautiful. They open that hardened heart just gets opened wide open. That's what I think St. Francis was talking about, that being caught up, and Pope Benedict writes about this beautifully. He says, falling in love is like Abraham leaving the country of Ur and travelling into the desert. It's quite an interesting version. And then he ties that in to the very first pages of Genesis. He says, that is why, where Adam goes, oh, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. He falls in love with Eve. And he says, this at last is bone of my bone. A recognition takes place. And he travels away from his family home. That is why man leaves his father and his mother's home and cleaves to his wife. That's a little Exodus story of self-giving love. And Benedict ties those two together. So it is an exodus, but it's an adventure that's a real adventure, not just a spiralling down one, but one that actually goes to true love, which is what we all want and all need. So, Anthony, I think it does. It makes you more concrete, not less. It makes you romantic in an outrageous kind of way, but more really present, really there. And just that, I think, ties into Chelsea's question again, is that you're not thinking... You do have big dreams and big ideas, but you start on it now. You're doing it here and now.
Nina, two more questions, Emma.
I'm referring to a whole lot at once, aren't I? The encyclical on the heart, it's very beautiful in Pope Benedict's writing, is Deus Caritas Est, God is love. That's the very first encyclical that he put out. When I refer to John Paul II, I'm referring to a whole lot of his writing. I'm referring particularly to his Theology of the Body catechesis, which was a series of Wednesday audiences. They're very challenging to read, but they have a great deal of great treasury of ideas there too. Yeah, it's a very in-depth way, and a lot of young people have found it really, really helpful in their, especially in marriage preparation. It can be fantastic. So, do recommend that. And I haven't seen that particular book, but it can be very helpful. I would always say my own bias is to say, read Theology of the Body with Benedict's heart, because that's you get the kind of sexuality in the body, but the heart aspect as well. And I think that is a beautiful complement. Because I know a lot of... I remember years ago when Christopher West, who's the great superstar of Theology of the Body, came out to speak in Melbourne. And I remember a couple of young men training for the religious life saying, yeah, it's great, but I kind of feel left out. Where does my vocation fit in to all of this? Now, John Paul does talk about the sexuality of the consecrated person, but it's not as kind of groovy, is it? It's harder to talk about. And so I think... The great thing about reading the two traditions together, if you like St. Thomas and the phenomenologist and the Augustinian tradition together, is you get both. You get the sort of great realistic psychological reality of St. Augustine and the great understanding of the beauty of the body from John Paul II. And I think those two are just a great mix. And they really complement each other well. I am. I'm also here because I've got a lot of material from the John Paul II Institute, where I'm a tutor, and we do actually have fantastic writers and speakers coming throughout the year. Now, we do offer postgraduate study, but also we offer audit courses. So I'm going to leave some of the material from the John Paul II Institute here, because we have one of the great scholars, a guy named Father Livio Molina, coming out during January, July. And anyone who's got questions or would like to know more information, I'm going to leave some material perhaps up on that table up there. So if anyone would like to have a look at that. Also, I'm here to say that one of the things I'm very strongly trying to support is for women to really be positive about being women, and if I can dare to say it without offending people, to promote a kind of new feminism. And that's part of what the Anima group that I'm in is doing in a network around Australia. Now, we're not activists. There's some great activist women's groups who we obviously link with, but this is more like a mutual support and network thing. So I'll leave some material there as well. So that's my ads for the day, and that's the end of my ads. Okay.
So I'm sure we've all greatly enjoyed Anna's talk, so can we just put our hands together to thank Anna for...
I didn't do infatuation and love. Okay. I didn't do infatuation and love, did I? Okay, postscript. Very quickly. What's the difference between infatuation? Who's never been infatuated? What do you think is the difference between true love and infatuation? This is one of the hard ones because your heart's involved in both of these, isn't it? What's infatuation? I'll tell you my first infatuation. I was infatuated with a boy in year grade who was 11 years old. He was the toughy person in the primary school. I thought he was great. And then I had an Indian arm wrestle with him and I wasn't really impressed anymore. I beat him, so that was the problem. Infatuation. Infatuation is a kind of emotional high that you often get when you meet someone that you find attractive, for whatever reason, personality, appearance. And the difference is that it's... the difference between love is... And sometimes true love can start as an infatuation. You know, you can start by being infatuated and then really fall in love with the person. Infatuation has these qualities. It's very about immediacy. I need a fix. You're not patient, are you, when you're infatuated? You keep thinking about it, you get kind of obsessed. Whereas with true love, there's a sense of knowing that true love grows over time. It's enriching. It doesn't make you feel like an addict. So a lot of the pop songs are about love, L-U-R-V, about being addicted to love and all that kind of hyper stuff. Is probably infatuation, I'd suggest. Secondly, it's very jealous and it seeks a kind of gratification, whereas true love is based on the best for the other person. Think about it. Infatuation makes you very out of character, bad-tempered, grumpy, grouchy, whereas true love confirms your true character, brings out the best. Remember we talked about that? Infatuation makes you impatient with everyone. You fret. You know when you say, that person's impossible to live with. They're infatuated. Whereas I think the interesting thing about true love is over time, it makes a person more caring for others. You actually see the good qualities of other people as well as the person you're in love with. Infatuation brings about emotional instability. Love really deepens values and decisions and it enjoys the present, the point that Anthony made. It makes you more concrete. Infatuation is furtive. You hide it. You're a bit embarrassed about it. You actually fall in love with being in love. I'm so in love, I'm over the moon. I'm in love with being in love and it's the best feeling ever. And then after a while you don't actually see the other person because you're so having a good high on your own high. Whereas true love brings out the inner depth of the people. Now everyone's entitled to be infatuated once in their life and most of us do. Even the wisest people have probably been infatuated. Another thing is though that infatuation over time makes you feel trapped and dependent. Whereas true love really encourages you to be the best person that you can be. So you begin to develop what John Paul calls self-mastery. It's worth waiting for. It's worth my controlling myself. It's worth my not being a rat bag or bad-tempered. It's worth me being better than I was. And true love means that when you're away from the person that's provoking your infatuation, you start to have doubts. You ask other people, do you think that person's really all right? You're actually not very convinced. It's not truth-telling to you. Whereas true love, I think, makes sense of life. Things start to fall together. Things begin to fit together. It makes sense of who you are. That's true love. So I think sometimes I put that little list together a few years ago to help young people when they were trying to work out what's the difference. And they always said to me, gee, that was really interesting. Can I get a copy? And that sort of thing. But it was something that helped them sort of separate the two things because infatuation is just such a normal thing to happen, but it's immature and it's just kind of a little squib, damp squib, whereas true love is what we are made to draw ourselves into. So that's just my little last little point there.
Just give you a bottle of Adelaide wine. It's better than Melbourne one, yeah, so you can, that's fine. And I think we'll close off the evening now from the talk and you can stay around and socialise and have another drink and...